Martin Krieger, University of Southern California. I want to echo Leon Trilling's remark about the influence of engineers. I don't know if any of your programs are designed to train, I hate the word, leaders. All right? It's one of those words that make me sick. But anyway, the business and entrepreneurship programs and so forth. Typically, business schools often, historically, especially under the influence of social science, were places where you mastered courses. Of late, they talk more about leadership and all that stuff. And so I think one of the things you have to think about is, what does it mean to create engineers who will be leaders? They may not be the people who publish the most articles in the best places, because they're two different skills. One involves Sitzfleisch, the other involves human skills, and they're very different. All you have to do is read promotion files, like I've done. So I think that's the most important thing. In other words, being smart and publishing a lot in the conventional way, which is, and getting lots of grants, which is the usual way to get promoted, which is perfectly fine, may not produce people who, it will produce randomly some extras, you know, by chance. And I think that's very important. And one of the reasons why game design is so popular is because the people who are doing this see themselves as not just designing a game, but becoming entrepreneurs. Just one last remark. Do you get poor kids, kids from poor families? When I was saying to someone before, this is 1960 when I was a freshman, poor kids studied science and engineering because that's where you could move. They didn't study liberal arts, and they certainly didn't study business. All right? Nowadays, I don't know what poor kids study, but you'd still think that science, engineering would be an attractive road. And poor, I mean, you know, rural background, families without much money, families without much education. And they're all related because this leadership stuff may well come out of people who don't have the usual qualifications.
I'd like to respond to this. First of all, the second part, I don't know about the poor kids in engineering. I do know that Brown takes a number of students who are the first in their family to go to college, and some who are totally supported because of, is this on? Okay, who are totally supported because of financial need, but I don't, when they come into my class, I don't know, you know, who's whom. But leadership, I really want to get to that. When I was at GE, which is where I was for 18 years, you know, it was very clear that the people who were excellent in the research were not necessarily the best leaders and managers. It just was a fact, and it's a different skill. Very preliminary, but we are beginning to think about a master's in engineering leadership at Brown, which would actually be for people who've been out for a while, and we want to bring them back. And next Friday, a week from today, we're having a two-hour meeting. We've already done all of space work on this with people who are not engineers who are going to contribute to this program, and more to come on that. But I think you're right on target. We've got to be thinking about the leadership component of this as well.
Can I just make a quick follow-up on that with respect to leadership? I think the sort of projects program, particularly where the students are off campus and are put in an environment where they have goals to meet, people to get to know and to work with, and to accomplish something in a relatively short time frame, is the environment that can develop leadership somewhat naturally versus studying it in a classroom. I don't want to put that down either, but the Sitzfleisch thing was a good point. There are students who are great at getting A's in classes, and when we pick students for our off-campus projects program and we see how they do, there's not a high correlation between grade point average and success in this off-campus project. So I think that really can lead to what we call leadership skills.
I agree with that. I think that leadership is something you discover within yourself but need the opportunity to do so. Do you still have a question in the front? And then I think, John, did you have your hand up in the back?
Harry Lewis from Harvard again. I just wanted to note a thought based on the first two presentations from WPI and Cal Poly, where WPI presentation began with a remark that someone there had made that, you know, if you want to work for Disney, you've got to be an engineer. And Cal Poly then gave this whole raft of examples of people who've come out of their LSE program and, you know, gone to Warner Brothers and other places like that. So while I don't think we should cast this, you know, I accept the premise that we ought to be, you know, we're designing an academic program, it ought to be intellectually and socially motivated and justified. But I think one of the things that the pioneers can do for us is to track data, collect data about what happens to people, to get out of the minds of our faculty colleagues the mythology that the industry only wants, the engineering industries only want engineers, that that in fact, you know, lots of creative people with much richer backgrounds are very much desired, not just licensed engineers, even in technology companies. Thank you.
I think we had a question over there in the back, and then we'll move over to this side of the room.
You can also stand at the microphones if you'd like to wait on either side rather than waiting for it to come to you. We've got one there in the middle and one over there.
Tunde Ogunike, University of Delaware. The WPI team made a statement that just went by in passing. And the question was, why, essentially, I'm paraphrasing now, why is the traffic more one-directional for engineering students coming to liberal arts as opposed to the other way? It's not unlike what happened in the early days of systems biology, in which engineers were working with biologists. And we still have at the University of Delaware a collaboration with Thomas Jefferson University. And we have courses that engineers could take in the medical school. People from medical school could take courses in engineering. Well, guess what? Engineers went to the medical school and took courses. We're still waiting for the medical student to come to engineering to take these courses. But the point is, there's a reason for this. The most compelling reason is background and preparation and training. Most people go into the liberal arts studies maybe because of a lack of affinity for calculus and the kinds of things that will make you succeed in engineering. And so you've gone down that path, and now the time comes, somebody shows up and says, why don't you come to our neighborhood to play? And the person says, gee, I don't have the tools to come and play in your neighborhood. The question is, if we really want this traffic to go back and forth, how far do we need to go in the early development to start making sure that people have at least, if not the dexterity, a lack of phobia, because people are absolutely terrified of algebra and calculus and the kinds of things that will make them come.
Can I quick response to that? Good point. Engineering as a profession, I think, is both blessed and cursed by the fact that it's one of the few professions that you can practice with only a bachelor's degree. We can talk more about that. But the other side of that is it's one of the only professions where you have to decide what your profession is going to be well before you graduate from high school to get the preparation you need. The other aspect with respect to why the traffic isn't more in two directions, it would be possible to teach engineering without all that preparation, but that's not the culture. We'd have to change the culture or add a parallel culture to teach engineering without all of that preparation. So it's an interesting dynamic.
Hello, John Krupsek from National Science Foundation. I just want to comment that there are some resources available to this group in regard to the issue that's come up about liberal arts students coming over to take classes in engineering. The American Society of Engineering Education, ASEE, actually has a division that's devoted to this exact topic. It's called Technological and Engineering Literacy, Philosophy of Engineering, or it goes by TELFI. Alan is actually an officer of the division. But just in terms of point of information, this is actually a fairly good-sized division in ASEE. It's one of the larger medium-sized divisions that was formed from exactly this type of event. There was a workshop in this exact building in 2005 on that particular issue. So in terms of resources available to the group, there's been 10 years of conference proceedings and work going on. So just asking people to think about availing yourself to some of those resources moving forward.
I have a comment and a question. First of all, a reaction to the statement that in this, in the degree that you are proposing, you have to have some research projects for the faculty because we're all promoted on research. I would like to counter that with the fact that in everything that has been presented here, these are all research projects, and we have to get away from the thinking that there is research that is creative and that requires all of our intellectual power, and there is the routine part that we do, which is teaching. And in that respect, I have a question to everybody here. In a way, we presented liberal arts and engineering as the solution, so or as it's all based on a given premise, a given hypothesis, and I'm hearing that there is some there are some issues that need to be addressed. So do these difficulties mean that the premise was not correct? Do these difficulties mean that the hypothesis needs to be revised? Do they raise other research questions? So if we see it as this is a research problem that we're all working on, what do you each see as the key or two or three very key research questions that you think we need all to be working on?
Please.
Yeah, I just...
Your panel can chime in at any time.
Respond to your first comment. I certainly didn't mean to imply that there's no research going on. There's huge amounts, and it's great. What I meant was at Brown, we need to start doing this kind of research more. That was my point there. In terms of the big questions, I think... I don't know, there's so many. All right, let others respond on that.
One thing I'd like to add to the discussion is a lot of times we're looking at how are we changing the engineers or how are we changing the liberal arts students. And I'd like us to consider that we're actually creating something new. And one of the questions we need to ask is, what are we creating? What are our majors? What are their roles going to be in society? And what we're seeing with our students when they graduate, they're not a watered-down engineer. They're not a technically inclined, a liberal art person. You know, they are something different, and there's a growing need in industry in our world to have these individuals go and contribute. Just like any other major, whether it's English or computer science or liberal arts and engineering studies, whether they're leaders or not depends on the individuals in there. And I think that question applies to every department and every major, and I don't think it's a solution to that. So as we continue to see how can we improve education for our students that we currently have, let's also consider what are we creating here and how do we guide that creation?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that as well. I mean, I think that we're trying to create something new in our students and in our culture, but I don't want us to overlook the difficulty of the newness we're trying to create in ourselves. You know, Snow talked about the two cultures, and I think maybe it was Harry in your opening question, will the liberal arts see this as helpful intervention on the part of the engineers, or will we see it as a threat? And I think that's a great question, because we do not just think differently. I think about this is simplifying a little bit, but the linear thinking of an engineer and the associative thinking of a humanist, and that doesn't mean everybody in engineering thinks that way, but sometimes we need to sit around the table and figure out what each other is saying and where we're coming from and how our methodology is different, because I think we tend to stereotype each other, and especially if we're in different parts of the campus. And so really to work through what it would mean to develop students who are able to think in all of these ways and value all these ways. And I think about the question of poor kids. Do you have poor kids? I think if we think about our poor kids, our students of color, and our women, and really try to develop interventions that help them, these interventions will help everyone because they engage. But that's a difficult thing to do. And I just heard an undergraduate student talk, and we were sitting around a table, and this was a student of color from a working class family, and he said, you know, my parents are spending all this money, I've got all these loans, I don't really want to work for the companies that come to the career center and recruit, but I can't see myself telling my parents that I don't want a job like that because that's security, and I don't know of any of my faculty, any of my professors I can talk to about this. And that's that cultural divide. And I would guess that faculty would be willing to talk if the students approached them, but it's a perception that you don't talk about your values, the kind of life you want to lead, the kinds of, you know, do you want a job where you frame the problem rather than solve the problem, that those are outside of the bounds of engineering education. And that's part of the cultural divide that I think we need to get past. And that's a huge obstacle, but it means sitting down and really devoting time to it.
Thank you. My name is Lonnie Bordloy. I'm here from the Teagle Foundation, and I wanted to echo what John from NSF said about the availability of resources for faculty and for institutions that are interested in integrating the liberal arts and engineering education. We currently have a request for proposals known as liberal arts in the professions, and one of our target areas is engineering. And we're very interested in ways in which engineering curricula can be reimagined and reconceived so that there's better integration of the liberal arts broadly writ into engineering, particularly at the upper division level, recognizing that there are structural challenges and cultural challenges to bringing this about. But we're very happy to be thought partners with you in bringing this work across. I think this meeting is very interesting and very productive. I'm very grateful that Larry and David have brought all of us together. If you have questions about the Teagle Foundation and our interest in this area, I'm happy to talk to you, and we can definitely be in touch.
Hi, I'm Brian Penfraise from Pomona College and also the Yale NUS College in Singapore. I'm very interested in hearing a bit more from your panel, all of you guys, about how you iterate with the other parties besides the faculty, that having student agency in designing these majors, such as David described, how the students come up with the rationale for their mix of courses, how that's incorporated in with advising and with a cohort of students, and how you engage the community and also corporations in presenting to these students and to faculty other potential outcomes, other potential purposes for the major, how the process of that works, how you create a space for faculty to discuss, students to discuss, and then iterate curriculum and individual student plans.
When we first started, there was a lot of sort of controversy about the program and whether it would be valuable or not. It would be dumbing down engineering, or it would be sort of a worthless connection of things because the students were coming it up with this on their own. And so the very first cohort of students who joined our program had to be a fairly brave or incredibly naive group of students. And they tended to be toward the brave, mainly because they had been going through a system that was telling them what to do all the time. And they were used to that, or they were being frustrated by that constantly. And they were aware of the fact that what they were being told to do was predicated on systems that were designed 20, 30 years prior to where they were existing at the time when they were going through the programs. We had the great benefit of having the economy fall apart right in the middle of running our trial program, which created a great degree of panic in the California State University system, that everyone thought everything was going to fall apart. And so what we had to do was look around and figure out how we could make the most out of the resources that were right in front of us. And that actually succeeded fairly well because it made it difficult for people to protect their little enclaves from each other when the entire kingdom was under attack. And so we got some cooperation from faculty in that regard. But also what happened with the students is it got them to really question why they were at the university to begin with, because they were spending really limited resources. We had students with entire families wiped out financially, and they were still trying to go to school. So these students had to explain to their families why they were, what they were doing at the university. So we had this great soul-searching moment with a lot of our students, and got them to figure out, what got them to ask constantly, what do you want to do and where do you want to go with this education? And the line that we've told them quite often is that the reason our program exists is to help them exploit the university as much as possible, to actually just bleed out of it everything that they want to get while they're there, and we will do the best to help them do that. But in response, they had to come up with very concrete reasons for how and why they wanted to put these things together. That was an interesting process to take a lot of students through who are not used to being asked that at the beginning or all the way through their process. Very frequently, we only ask students that at the end. Maybe when they're 16, when they first figure out they want to go to university, and then we seem to not ask that in between those two points. What we do in the LES program is we ask them that every 6 months. We make them stand up in public venues constantly. We constantly take them down to present to partners that we're working with to explain not only what the program's doing, but what they're doing as new professionals and how they're putting these things together. We've never had an instance when we've gone to talk to an industry and have them say, oh, no, I'm sorry, we want the full-on engineers. We get the opposite. We get it constantly, where we get the engineers who say, oh, my God, if that program had existed when I was an engineer, I would have taken it because I spent so long putting these other things together on my own. So the industry sees that hybrid nature of what's going on. The students saw it, and eventually I think the university saw it as a way of preserving limited and diminishing resources because it was a way of stitching them together to actually make the university function the way it does. And it got our university really asking this question all across the board about how are we functioning as an institution if we don't have more money coming in, we have students supporting more and more of this on their credit cards, how do we justify what we're doing? And the response has been to create more of this hybrid nature. We now have more of these interdisciplinary programs at Cal Poly than we've had before. And I think it's just because people saw that it could be possible.
So we've only got a few minutes before lunch. So in the back, I think we have a question on the roving microphone.
Yeah, this is Joe Pitt from Virginia Tech again. Just two observations. John Orr, you can do a lot to change the culture of engineering by having your new institution, ABET, become a partner in this activity. Right now, they stand as an obstacle. And the second thing I'd like to note is that on the question of why don't more liberal arts students take engineering courses, oftentimes there are institutional barriers set up by the engineering units to having non-engineers in their classes, so they freeze them out. So that's just a fact. But getting ABET involved as a cultural partner in this movement would be helpful.
Can I make a quick response? Don't want to sound defensive, and I think I've been at WPI for 37 years. I was department head for 15 years, prepared my department, electrical and computer engineering, for 3 ABET visits. But before that, as I say, WPI changed to this very revolutionary program in 1970. We've modified it some, made it, we might say, less revolutionary, but at the time, we had no required courses, as an example, and a very non-traditional grading system. All of our engineering programs have always been accredited. Now, ABET hasn't always been happy with us, and sometimes they came back in 3 years rather than 6. But we had the courage to move forward, and ABET, I would say, has moved forward with us. And so I'd encourage us all to test ABET, and we will work with you.
Let's take one more question here and then break for lunch. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Diane Michaelfelder from McAllister. Just a quick pre-lunch anecdote and then a quick question. The anecdote was triggered by what you said about students at Cal Poly having to choose their major when they're 16 years old. When I was there in the philosophy department, I had a good student who had come to Cal Poly to major in aeronautical engineering. I had no interest for it, had no talent for it, but as you saw from the slides, Cal Poly's about 12 miles or so from the Pacific Ocean. What he really wanted to do was surf, so he just chose the one that was at the top of the list, began with A, and fortunately it worked out for him. My question's this. You had mentioned, David, or this could really be for anybody on the panel, that things work much better once faculty saw that there was a connection between. Was there a faculty development piece involved in any of that? Faculty reading groups, opportunities to develop curricula together, and this would hold for if anybody cares to respond.
Yes, there was an informal one when I showed the Center for Expressive Technologies. That was actually an outgrowth of all the friendships that developed from us sharing with these projects back and forth. So it was informal development in that we would pull together people from different departments that we needed to answer or resolve difficult problems that we're solving for some aesthetic purpose for a stage show or something like that. And what happened is that it got people in each other's classrooms. It got people talking to each other, just solving the problem as they were working through it. So it became an informal development piece. I think over time we'd like to make that much more formal, and that's what we're doing with the Center for Expressive Technology, because we're trying to solve the funding issue. So that brings money into a central place, and then we can put it back into the departments to compensate people for their time to participate in these projects, where mostly we've been using goodwill, and we know that we're going to wear that out after a certain amount of time. So now we're paying people for their participation. That makes a huge difference.
Can I make just one further comment on that with respect to the tactics? Tactics are important too. Our great problem, our problem seminars, we instituted about 6 years ago, and the vehicle we used there was the university-wide desire to improve our first-year experience. That first-year experience was sort of the hot topic at WPI, and I think at many schools, and it still is. Well, we brought in the great problem seminars as an approach to substantially improving first-year experience for all the students. It was a tactic, a means to an end.
So I think we're all ready for lunch, so let's thank